Welcome to What in the World. My name is Ryan Rosenthal, joined today by not only Andre Ganuela, but Javed Ali as well, our executive producer. And there's a lot to talk about today. I want to start off with this cyber attack against JBS, which is the world's largest meat supplier. And so this hacking, right, is another one that we've seen. You know, we had this colonial pipeline hacking, we had SolarWinds. And so Javed, I want to kick it off to you and kind of orient us. What's happened? What's been the governmental response? What's been the company's response? And really, how is this being managed?
Yeah, thanks, Ryan, for that tip. And always great to be with you and Andre. So on the cyber front, I mean, it's kind of dizzying at this point, right? So there's so much happening in the real world. And it seems just over the past couple of weeks, almost every day, there's been the report or there's been reports of another cyber breach or attack or hack or some industry gets affected. And so if you just step back to what the cyber threat landscape looked like, I would say probably beginning of 2020 to where we are now, literally in the middle of 2021, I would argue that would appear that the scope and pace and velocity of these high profile attacks anyways, because there's every day there's thousands and thousands of smaller ones that no one sort of, or they don't get mentioned, that these high profile ones, again, there seems to be this just growing trend. And what's interesting is that they're coming from multiple adversaries. They're using different tactics and techniques, and they're going after different targets and vulnerabilities here in the United States. So it's not just coming from one particular sort of threat vector. It's very multifaceted and very diverse. And that, I think, is making it very difficult for the Biden administration to come up with a coherent strategy at this point, other than just tactically responding to each of these incidents as they occur.
So it sort of sounds like a tit for tat at this point, right? Like, I mean, they attack us, we attack them. Are we adequately prepared for like some of these cyber attacks? Like, do we need to shore up our like cyber defense capabilities? Is that a thing? Like, I mean, what's going on here?
Well, going back to just the diversity of the different adversaries out there. So even from the last 2 weeks alone, which is not the totality of what this threat landscape looks like, but even from the last 2 weeks alone of what's been revealed publicly, attacks allegedly from the Russian intelligence service, the SVR, against one part of the State Department or the USA Agency for International Development, which also then affected a bunch of other non-governmental organizations and think tanks. And apparently that operation was an attempt by the SVR to basically send a message to all these anti-Putin dissidents or critics. But they used sort of getting into the US aid system as the way of doing the discovery on all these other possible targets. So there was that one. Then just yesterday, there was the news of a alleged Chinese government-sponsored operation into the New York Metropolitan Transit Authority subway system. Now, that wasn't a ransomware attack, that information or data wasn't encrypted or systems weren't locked up. But according to the news reporting, that some part of the Chinese security or some part of the Chinese security service or element got into that system and was doing at least digital reconnaissance. Who knows, what kind of sort of digital tools have been left in place to do other things. And then on the criminal side, we've again seen in the last couple of weeks, we had the Colonial Pipeline attack that was launched from Russia with this criminal group that's virtual, as far as we know, called Dark Winds. We have the JBS attack, Andre, as you just mentioned, from another apparent Russian-based criminal hacking organization, also using ransomware, just like in the Colonial Pipeline attack. And so it's just a litany of these types of operations. And how the Biden administration chooses to respond to these different threats is part of the challenge, because it's not monolithic. It's not like all these operations are only being launched by, you know, the Russian SVR or the Chinese Ministry of State Security or just one of these criminal Russian criminal hacking groups. They're all happening in this very compressed time frame, and you have to use different tools and kind of pull different levers of national power to address them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's important to point out that you have both state and non-state actors here. And so while, you know, on the surface, it seems like this criminal group is not tied to the Russian state, you never know, right? In Russia, they have very strong internet laws. And so, you know, if something happens, an external operation against a US or some other actor, whether it be a private sector company or a government entity, it would at least seem to me that the Russian government could have some sort of influence on it. And so I know that the White House has said that President Biden will broach this subject with President Putin at their upcoming summit, after the G7. And so, but this really just highlights the broader issue of dealing with cyber on an international scale, because every country, every business, every individual is impacted by these cyber issues.
Right. And this is a very different type of threat than the threats that manifest in the physical domain. So whether that's from terrorism or nation states with using conventional military force. I mean, these types of attacks and operations for the most part are happening digitally and then have potential to have physical effects downstream, like we saw in the impact or in the case of the Colonial Pipeline attack, or perhaps, you know, we'll see the fallout of the JBS attack against the meatpacking industry or the meat distribution industry. But when it's hard to see the immediate effects of these attacks, that also, I would think, complicates the decision-making about what to do in response to it. So does the U.S., when these types of attacks happen, either against government systems or against private sector equities that are being affected, does the U.S. try to retaliate in kind? Does it try to respond in the conventional world? I don't mean militarily, but just, again, things that have a physical effect. Does it send very strong and tough messages diplomatically? We've seen this in the past. Apparently in 2015, when Chinese economic espionage, mostly through cyber means, was at an extremely high level and pace, there's lots of reporting that President Obama, in no uncertain terms, told President Xi at that time to knock it off and to stop. And here we are 6 years later, and I don't think that message, for the most part, was heeded. I mean, there may have been a temporary drop, but if the reports about what this Chinese operation against the New York subway system are true, then again, that's just another manifestation of that. And President Trump apparently sent strong messages to President Putin about Russian cyber operations stemming from as far back as the 2016 election interference campaign to all the other Russian cyber operations that were being launched under his presidency. Again, didn't really seem to change Russian behavior. And then in the aftermath of the SolarWinds attack, even before news of the Colonial Pipeline attack, which was launched by a criminal group, President Biden announced a very comprehensive plan to deal with Russian cyber aggression, either from security elements or these criminal groups that operate on Russian soil, sanctions, sort of diplomatic kind of maneuvers, a 34-page executive order on cybersecurity that is the longest and most comprehensive executive order ever published by the U.S. government on this threat in terms of what more the government needs to do, working hand in glove with private industry. But again, none of these things seem to have altered the behavior or imposed the right series of costs or deterred this range of adversaries that we're now seeing from conducting these operations. So what more needs to happen? And that's something that one would think in advance of the meeting between President with the president and President Putin in a couple of weeks, one would think the NSC is already preparing a whole list of options that President Biden can pick from to say in that meeting with President Putin, here are some of the things we are prepared to do to you if you don't stop, because these have to be credible threats. There's no point in issuing a threat if you can't back it up. So I think it'll be fascinating to see how that plays out in a couple of weeks and how much of that conversation is revealed publicly or whether it just stays private between the two leaders.
Absolutely. Javed, thanks for joining us here today. You made an appearance, I think, on ABC News, actually, which we'll link in the description, sort of giving your thoughts, and you might be making some more appearances fairly soon. So we'll keep our audience posted about that. But thanks for joining us and telling us about, I mean, this very important issue that have sort of fallen away from the attention of most of the American public.
All right, great. Thanks, guys.
So Ryan, now let's sort of dig into what's been going on in Israel. I mean, we saw the conflict that's been occurring, but now we actually have a political situation developing where Benjamin Netanyahu, who has been prime minister for 12 years, who was, I think, prime minister prior to that, the late 90s, for about 2 to 3 years, but his current tenure has been 12 straight years. We've seen, I think, maybe 4 elections in the past year and a half or 2 years. It looks like he's finally going to be out. It looks like his term is finally coming to an end, because what's basically happening is as some people on Twitter have pointed out, Netanyahu was so divisive, he actually united the right wing and the left wing. And I mean, when I say right wing, I mean like right wing. So the right wing, led by Naftali Bennett, came to a coalition deal with Yair Lapid, who leads the left wing. And they've gone to the president, President Reuven, and they said, like, hey, we have this coalition government of virtually left and right wing. I'll be prime minister for the first year, and Lapid will be the prime minister for the second year. And I think Bennett, I mean, he, according to the New York Times, he opposes a Palestinian state. He is seen as very religious. He's seen as very religious nationalist. According to the deal, he's going to be prime minister until about 2023. And then Lapid will be sort of prime minister for the last 2 years. And in my view, a coalition as colossal as that will not last a year. So I don't think Lapid will be prime minister at all. But I think really the goal is to get Netanyahu out of power. I think that is literally the goal here.
If we just look at parliamentary politics, this is a terrible idea, right? I mean, I completely agree with you. Like, I can't imagine this can stay together. I mean, there's so much going on. I didn't think I'd live to see the day when Bibi Netanyahu would be ousted as PM, which is crazy to say because he's far older than I am. But Bibi's still fighting, right? He's likely going to delay this no confidence vote, which is required for him to be ousted. And he can put pressure on this fragile coalition. And as you said, Andre, right, you have the left, you have the right, you have this Arab party, Ram.
The most powerful Arab politician in Israeli history right now.
Right. Yeah. And so, listen, it's kudos to them for being able to put this together. But I mean, they don't see eye to eye on really anything other than ousting Netanyahu, which I guess might be a rallying cry. But I mean, listen, you said, yes, there's been 4 elections in 2 years. There's no budget. There's no stability. Israel's just been through this most recent war. And with which many analysts have said, like, this might have been good for Netanyahu, like having this war, because Netanyahu tends to succeed when there's conflict just because he tends to create a strong and secure Israel. Exactly. Yes. He is the security guy. Yes. But look at where we are now, right? I mean, we are on, you know, the verge of having Netanyahu be ousted as the longest serving prime minister of the state of Israel. But I mean, again, you know, I'm not sure where this is really going to go. And I think it'll probably hold, but I can't imagine the coalition will. I mean, it's very likely that Netanyahu's days are gone, and he'll, you know, face this, you know, prosecution for these bribery charges. But that aside, right, I mean, at the end of the day, you want stability in the state of Israel, or else, right, it's a breeding ground for further conflict and destabilization, just because on the Palestinian side, Andre, as you and I have talked about, there's immense instability when you have these two forces, one in Gaza, Hamas, and one in the West Bank, Fatah. And so when you have instability in Israel and instability in the Palestinian territories, That's a recipe for disaster.
And also, let me make it clear, it's not like significant, like it's like political, like partisan. It's like really, it's a very partisan environment, like just like we are. Like, I mean, we could be considered unstable along those same lines. It's not nothing like the Palestinian instability. But I mean, what does this mean for his like prosecution, like his potential prosecution? I mean, with someone like him, I feel like he will be back in power at some point, but like, I mean, is it realistic for him to come back?
Honestly, I would say no. I don't
really.
Yeah, I mean, listen, once he's out, right, then he has to face the justice system of the state of Israel, which it's an independent judiciary, right? They're gonna pursue these charges. He's no longer prime minister. I mean, really, that's the only thing kind of keeping this case from really moving quicker. And so with kind of that out of the way, I can't see a scenario in which that they don't pursue charges. And if he is, you know, convicted, well, then you really think he's going to be, you know, a coalition's going to then put him back up into the, you know, premiership? That seems a bit far-fetched, at least in my mind.
I mean, look at what's happening in our own system right now, Ryan. I mean, I'm just saying. But I mean, I've seen Netanyahu's social media. He's going ham on, sorry, that's not kosher, but like he's going ham on basically the opposition, the coalition and all of that stuff, right? Like, I mean, he is calling them all the names in the book.
I really wish our audience could see my face right now with that very lame, not kosher joke, but I'll let it slide. But it's absolutely right. He is basically taking a page from the Trump playbook and saying, beware of the far left. They're going to destroy Israel. You know, you're going to lose all your freedoms and yada, yada, yada. So that similar vein of, you know, it's me or the highway. And so, I really don't know how this is going to play out. But I mean, Netanyahu is in a pinch right now, and he's got to make very, very deliberate political moves in order to kind of break apart this coalition, right? He has to depend on just a handful of very powerful players in the Knesset, Israel's parliament, in order to kind of ensure that he maintains power. And that's that prospect, at least to me, seems dim.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, he's going to really try as much as he can, but I don't think he'll succeed. And I think there you have it. That's the bookend on his premiership. Bye-bye, Bibi.
Right, and I guess what we're going to see is a very conservative, right-leaning Israel, and then you're going to do a 180 and have a very left-leaning Israel over the span of 4 years.
It's like if AOC made a coalition with Ted Cruz and, you know, suddenly have Ted Cruz being president for 1 year and AOC the next year.
Wild. I mean, it's truly wild. So, I mean, again, you know, when sometimes people like to say that, you know, parliamentary systems are far more stable than systems like the United States. But I can't see that at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, in Sri Lanka, like they had a similar situation. You had this strong and leader, Rajapaksa, who was in power for 10 years, becoming a bit more authoritarian. So I think the more right wing, like fiscally conservative and so on, but socially liberal, they picked this guy from his cabinet. And they're on different ends of the spectrum. And this guy was president, the other guy was prime minister. And then they started stabbing each other in the back. And now Rajapaksa is back in power in five years later. So it was a sort of similar, weird, fragmented coalition that worked out for like a year and then fell into chaos in the next few years. But speaking of Sri Lanka, I want to call our attention to Sri Lanka is a country that's given me a lot of heartburn for many reasons. I was born there. I'm an American citizen, but it is my homeland. There's basically been this significant environmental disaster there. This container ship was stricken with fires, and it's basically in the process of sinking off Sri Lanka's western coast as of Wednesday. And a lot of oil and a lot of other dangerous chemicals is basically leaking into the ocean and is going to create just this significant environment crisis, a lot of bad pollution. And it's not going to be fun for Sri Lanka at all.
I mean, absolutely not. This has, I mean, it would have a devastating effect on, right? I know fishing is a huge part of Sri Lanka's economy. You also have those beaches, which unbeknownst to me, Sri Lanka has some very beautiful beaches. I was kind of perusing some photos as we were preparing for this podcast, and I mean, it looks lovely. But I guess, you know, at the moment, right, you also have these little plastic pellets that have, you know, dumped into the ocean. So that impacts marine life. You have the oil spill, you have other chemicals there. And so this, it really seems to be, you know, we're on the verge of an environmental disaster off the coast of Sri Lanka, which unfortunately, at least, won't probably get the international attention that it deserves, just because it's a lot of other things happening in the world.
Yeah. And the ship was, you know, it started off its voyage in Dubai. It was going to go to Malaysia. And apparently the fire has been going on since May 20th. Wow. So, I mean, I assume there'll probably be some like criminal investigations at some point by some country, probably Sri Lanka, perhaps Dubai or Malaysia, but that'll be an interesting thing to keep track of. I mean, as you know, Sri Lanka is a very strategic port, sort of the gateway of the Arabian Sea and the Indian Ocean to Southeast Asia. So we'll see what's going to be going on with that. It's a fast developing situation.
All right. Well, you know, speaking of, you know, oil and other issues, let's look to Iran next. The first thing, I guess, in 2 days, there were two very big fires. An interesting coincidence, one of which was at an oil refinery in Tehran, the capital of Iran. And so there's, you know, no immediate knowledge as to the source of this fire, but it's quite hot in Iran at this, you know, time of summer. It's happened before. We've had the immense heat of the summer cause fires. And so, you know, it might not be nefarious activity, but you also have this huge, one of the largest naval vessels of in the Iran Navy caught fire and sank. And so again, the origination of this fire is unclear, but it, literally the same day. And so, coincidence?
Who knows? Is it happening from the inside or the outside? That's the question.
Well, I'm unaware.
I'm not making any assumptions about who might have done it, but you never know, right? I mean, it's not like there are these centrifuges that just exploded spontaneously back in 2010 in Iran. So,
yeah. Anyway. So a couple of other updates. You know, we've been talking about a lot of different areas of the world over the on this What in the World, one of which is Belarus. Not a whole lot of positive updates there. That that co-founder of Nexta, which is this kind of online media platform, is still imprisoned. And of course, you know, despite the international outrage and sanctions being levied by, you know, Western powers, the EU in particular, no kind of movement. There was actually, so Russia actually in the early days of, right, following this incident, Russia decided to not allow European flights to come into Russia because they said, if you're going to do it, you have to go via Belarusian airspace. And they all said no for obvious reasons. And so that has, you know, subsided. So there might, I guess we're kind of returning to normalcy, which is deeply unfortunate for the pro-democracy activists in Belarus, as well as this journalist and media professional who is, you know, imprisoned, and his fate is likely, you know, very, you know, it's not going to be great for him. It's just not going to be good. But again, if we also looked at Ethiopia, we talked about it. It's only getting worse and worse. The U.S., while they said that, you know, they're going to limit assistance to them, it seems like the Ethiopian government is, you know, maintaining their stance of putting down the quote unquote treasonous government in the Tigray region. And so again, a humanitarian disaster there as well.
That's very scary. And I mean, it really highlights the need for us on this podcast, of course. I mean, that's why we do What in the World, right? For talking about what's happening in the world, in so many regions, don't necessarily hear about. I mean, you turn on world news. World news is really American news, right? On ABC or CBS and so on. So that's what we're trying to do here. Ryan, is there anything else as we're closing off? You mentioned two big things, Belarus and Ethiopia.
So not a lot yet. I will say, stay tuned. We have the G7 summit occurring next week. And so there'll be a lot of updates on that, right? You have many of the world's leading powers coming together to discuss, you know, the world, from issues from global security to global health to the economy to humanitarian issues. And so that, of course, there'll be a lot of important information and developments coming out of that. We'll have a special episode coming out by the end of next week. We'll cover it on What in the World. But yeah, and so in addition to that, we have a great episode coming out on Monday. Andre, why don't you preview that?
So we have a former Secretary of Defense who's going to be joining us, Secretary Leon Panetta. He'll be coming in to talk about his time as Secretary of Defense, his prognosis for the Biden administration, and a lot of other great things. It's going to be a big interview, probably our biggest interview. It'll be a great one. And we're also having a session, I think, with Fiona Hill, the esteemed Russian expert. Which I think will be released on the next Monday as well. So like a lot of great, exciting stuff, a lot of great content.
And always, you know, make sure to give us feedback, send us an email. First and foremost, thank you all for listening. Make sure to rate, review, and subscribe to us on whatever platform you listen to it. And we'll see you as always next week.
See you, folks.